We are in Luke chapter 5 tonight. This is going to be the last Wednesday that we'll be meeting together on Luke. Next Wednesday we are not meeting because of the Founders Conference. And the Wednesday after that, Glenn Woods and Price Jones will begin their study in systematic theology, and that will be held on Wednesday nights. So starting in October, the first Sunday in October, the Luke series will be transferred to the Sunday afternoon series. And as I've said already, it'll be the longest review in Heritage history. But it's going to be for our good, right? Okay, for our good. You keep reminding me how it's for your good, and keep me humble. Well, we are in Luke 5. Something marvelous has happened in Galilee. Maybe you have picked up on it as we've been looking through Luke 4, especially when Jesus comes to Nazareth and Capernaum. Something marvelous has happened. The king has arrived. Have you noticed that? Gabriel said to Mary way back in chapter 1, he said that the Lord would, regarding this son that she is going to be carrying, the Lord will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob. This king has arrived in Galilee. Mary saying that the arrival of this king would be a display of the strength of God's arm. She's saying that the reign of this king would be seen in removing the mighty from their thrones and in sending the rich away empty. That it would be seen in the raising of the lowly and filling of the hungry. That this king would hold his scepter and speak his decrees in such a way as people would know for sure that God was remembering his promises of mercy to Abraham and to his seed forever. It's this king who has arrived in Galilee. Zacharias is saying that in the arrival of this king, God had raised up his horn or his strength of salvation. That by this warrior king, we would be saved from our enemies and from all who hate us. And not only would we be delivered from our enemies, not only that, we would be delivered unto God Himself to serve Him without fear all the days of our life. This king has arrived in Galilee. Simeon in the temple, he took up the infant Jesus in his arms? Took him up in his arms and he declared that he was seeing God's salvation. He took up the infant Jesus in his arms, holding him in his arms, and he said that he was looking at the one who would be a light to the Gentiles, the one who is the glory of Israel. This king has arrived in Galilee. The king's herald, John the Baptist, preached saying that this king holds a winnowing fan in his hand and is cleaning his threshing floor. And all of his wheat will be safely gathered into his barn, and all of the chaff will burn with unquenchable fire. This king has arrived in Galilee. Something marvelous has happened. And that serpent of old brought out all of his most cunning schemes and devices and lies that had always worked before. And with a word, Jesus walks into the strong man's house and completely binds him with a word. This is the king who has arrived in Galilee. This is the king who has stepped out of the wilderness and has stepped into the Galilean region and is preaching in their synagogues. Now, that's something marvelous, but there's also a certain sadness which has attended our reading so far in Luke 4. And the sadness is that we are still waiting for a reception that's fitting for this king. Kings are worthy of a reception, are they not? And what have we seen so far? This is the king that Luke has prepared us for. This is the king who has now arrived in Galilee and is preaching in their synagogues. And what kind of a reception has he been given so far? Well, Luke has taken us to two different towns. First, he took us to Nazareth. Two synagogues, two reactions, and they're not as different as they might initially seem. In Nazareth, they had heard of the miracles. They had come to their synagogue with great expectations to hear of this amazing teacher that they've heard about, healing people, preaching incredible sermons. They've come to hear what Jesus will say, and most certainly they came to that Nazareth synagogue that morning to see what he might do. And they hear him open up there, as we saw in 4 verse 18. They hear him open up Isaiah 61. They hear him explain that Isaiah's prophecy of the great messianic age is in fact being inaugurated and fulfilled, and it's being accomplished in his words as he preaches. As Jesus said, this is fulfilled in your hearing. It's fulfilled in your ears. His words were gracious. His preaching was with authority and undeniable power and wisdom. And Luke tells us that they listened and they marveled at what he was saying. But then we see very quickly that their marveling and astonishment did not lead to repentance. In fact, the root of their marveling may have been envy, because they're listening and they're marveling at what he's saying. And then all of a sudden they say, wait a second. We know who you are. You're Joseph's son, Luke tells us. Matthew and Mark work that out a little bit more for us in their accounts, where they say, they look around and say, we know Mary, your mother, and your brothers and sisters, they're here with us. And so they were offended. We know who you are. You're the one who grew up here. We grew up with you. We know all about you. Here you come making these claims from the book of Isaiah, from the scroll of Isaiah. So they were offended that Mary's son would boast like this. How dare he act like this? How dare he act like he's better than the rest of us? And by acknowledging him as merely Joseph's son or merely Mary's son, they were revealing that they really didn't know who he was. They thought they knew. They look at Jesus and they think, well, he's too ordinary. And so they despise him. He's too ordinary to act like a great teacher. And Jesus, then, if you remember, he looked out on the faces of that Nazareth synagogue. You know what he sees? He sees the nation of Israel as it was in the days of Elijah and Elisha. That's what he sees in their faces. Not much has changed. And he tells them so. And ironically, they hate him for saying it. They hate him for comparing them to their fathers who murdered the prophets, and they hate him so much they want to take him out and murder him. Now, you tell me that makes sense. They don't know who he is. This is why they're acting this way. His works and his words show, but they do not and they will not believe. Certainly their response to his rebuke indicates that. So don't think that Jesus is unkind by comparing them to their fathers. He was pointing out their sin, and thus it was an opportunity for them to lay down their pride and presumption. There was an opportunity right there. That Sabbath morning in the synagogue was an opportunity for them to just lay it down and say, you're right. We confess our sins. Have mercy on us. Have mercy on us. And according to the gospel, or the gospel of Isaiah, according to the prophecy of Isaiah, Heal our brokenheartedness. We need the liberty proclaimed to us. This is an opportunity, but of course they did not take that opportunity. The Spirit of God, when we read that in Nazareth, the Nazareth synagogue, the Spirit of God probes our hearts with the Scripture so that we have to ask ourselves the question, do we know who Jesus is? Do you know who he is? A marvelous thing has happened in Galilee. This king described by Luke has arrived. Do you know who he is? Really? Well, then Luke takes us to the second synagogue here. He takes us to Capernaum. They go to their synagogue that Sabbath morning. They're very interested hearing him. And they don't have to rely on news and rumor. They actually witness his works, and his works start right there in the synagogue. He doesn't even leave yet. Right there in the synagogue, a man who is possessed with a demon cries out with a loud voice and disrupts the service, and Jesus has to immediately start dealing with that. So they witness his power. They've heard his preaching. They marvel at the power. They marvel at his authority, Luke tells us, and now they are marveling at the power of his word, that he speaks but a word and the demon leaves and obeys. And before the day is over, they have heard his preaching. They have witnessed numerous people delivered from demons with a word. They have witnessed numerous sick people instantly and completely healed with a word. And they beg him to stay. They beg him to stay, which might initially seem like a good way to receive the king. Maybe finally, here we are, right? We've gone through all of this foundation work describing who this king will be and what he will be like and what he will do. And he certainly wasn't received in the wilderness. We weren't expecting that. But maybe in his own hometown, we had to go through all of that. No proper reception for the king. That was obvious. And now we finally come, and here in this town, they are tugging on his sleeves, trying to pull him back into town, seeking to keep him from leaving, which might initially seem like a good way to receive a king, begging him to stay. But by doing so, they reveal that they do not yet truly understand his purpose, as Jesus had to point out for them, which reveals they do not yet truly understand who he is. So, do you know who he is? A marvelous thing has happened. A king has arrived in Galilee, and we are still looking. You might almost get frustrated with Luke because you're waiting. You want this king to have his reception that's fitting for him and worthy of him. When will it happen? And surely it'll be a wonderful moment. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. The reception of this king that has been prophesied and promised. Well, tonight in Luke 5, you're going to witness a reception worthy of this king. You're going to witness a reception that's fitting for this king, and you're going to witness a reception, a response that Jesus receives, which is something that Jesus has not done yet. So look at Luke 5 and verse 1. So it was as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God that he stood by the lake of Gennesaret. The Sea of Galilee is the same thing. The Sea of Tiberias, the Lake of Tiberias. These are all names for the same body of water. He's out there on the northern shore, there probably by Capernaum. Luke tells us he's out there and the crowd is pressing about him to hear his preaching. And as he's standing out there, he stood by the Lake of Gennesaret and he saw two boats standing by the lake. So these boats that are drawn up onto the shore, the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. Now, this is an important detail. We know that Simon Peter was a fisherman. At the beginning of verse 3, one of the boats, you see there, Luke tells us, one of the boats belonged to Simon. So Simon Peter was a fisherman. One of the boats belongs to Simon. And initially here we see that Simon's not in his boat. He and the other men working with him were out of the boats. And the reason, Luke tells us, is that they were cleaning their nets. That's why they're not currently in the boat. Now, just hold on to that for a second, because it provides an interesting perspective here in just a moment. They're out cleaning their nets. Now, verse 3 may simply be just a logistic issue. He got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and taught the multitudes from the boat. So it's just simply, I think, a matter of Jesus is, he's having to find a position where he can get out a little ways from the press of the crowd and you know, the shoreline necessitates that they all stay sort of in a line up there, and he's out here and he can face them all. And now it's a little bit easier for them to hear, for them all to hear what he's going to teach them as he sits down in the boat. So it's just a simple teaching arrangement. Now, verse 4. He evidently is preaching for some time. When he stopped speaking, he said to Simon, "Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." Let down your nets for a catch. Now, take a moment to think about what Jesus is asking Peter to do. He's essentially saying to Peter, "Let down your freshly cleaned nets. You've just done all this work, cleaning them, folding them, making them ready for the next day's work." So he's asking Peter. So he's asking him to do something. He's asking him to do a lot. Let's not miss the significance of the request. Let down your freshly cleaned nets. That's one part of it. Now, if this were a situation of one fisherman to another, that might have been okay, but that's not what we have. We have a rabbi, we have a teacher, and Peter refers to him respectfully here in a moment when he calls him master. This is a term that Luke uses, that people would use referring to a teacher or a rabbi. It's a term of respect. But it's not one fisherman to another. It's a non-fisherman directing an experienced fisherman how to do his work. Let down your freshly cleaned nets out in the deep in the middle of the day. This is the request. And Jesus speaks expectantly. Notice what he says. Let down your nets, not because we're going to see what happens. And that's what the rest of us do who fish, right? We go out and we have no idea what's going to happen. And for some people, that's fun. Even if nothing happens, it's just the fun of fishing. But Jesus expectantly says, let down your nets for a catch. Well, verse 5. So verse 4, don't miss that this is, I think, a significant request. And I think Peter, on one hand, shows quite a bit of restraint in one way, though the answer is not completely what he should have said. And I'll point that out here in just a moment as we go through it. But notice verse 5, he says, Simon answered and said to him, "Master, we have toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net." Now, notice that Peter says that he's toiled all night. Peter has not slept yet. Okay, he's worked all night. He says so. Fishing at night probably gave, he was doing that probably because it gave him some advantage. You know, maybe you've done that kind of fishing where you go out on the pier on a boat, you do it at night, and you take the temperature of the day was affecting the catch of fish and the cycle of the fish eating. We know things like that. And maybe some of you have gone out at night with lights, and so, and this is just a guess on my part. No, but maybe men did this at night, even at this time. They would take lamps, some kind of a lantern, and hang them over the side of the boat and attract the smaller feeder fish, which would in turn attract the bigger fish that Peter was aiming to catch. There's something like that could very well have been going on, but there's some advantage to Peter and the men that he's working with or the men that work for him to go out at night to catch the fish. He has been out all night and he hasn't caught anything. Nothing, he says. Which surely must have been pretty frustrating for Peter, because he's worked all night and it's been all cost and no profit to him. He's come back to shore with no paycheck. He's gotten out of the boat. He's gotten all of his equipment and his tackle and all the things they use. He's pulled this out of the boat and he's been cleaning his nets, mending them perhaps, getting them ready for the next night. Maybe even Peter is doing all this expecting that he's going to get this done and then he's going to go home and go to sleep. And he'll wake up sometime in the afternoon, he'll go back out that next night and he'll get at it again with the fishing. So he's come back, it's morning, he's worked in the morning, but now Jesus is utilizing his boat. And we don't know for sure how long Jesus was teaching. Maybe it's now mid-morning, maybe it's now noon. And I'm sure that however tired Peter was when he first came back at daybreak, now Peter's probably even more tired. And this rabbi, this great teacher, and Peter certainly doesn't deny that, there are great things that Peter has seen in Capernaum already. And now this teacher says, go out into the deep in the middle of the day, where normally probably a fisherman would not have gone to cast his nets. Go out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Now, Peter uses the term respect here, but his response, I think, shows that he does not yet understand. I think if Peter had understood who it was talking to him, his answer might have sounded like this: Master, I will let down the net. I think that would have been a sufficient answer. Master, I will let down the net. But notice what he says. Master, we have toiled all night. Do you hear what's in his answer? I'm going to do this, but there's something that obviously you're not understanding about what I've just been through. There's something that you obviously don't understand. I've already tried this today. But nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net. I don't think it's quite the answer that Peter would have given if he really knew who he was talking to. Verse 6 now. Peter does this. They push out. They go out into the more deep waters. Well, maybe it's 30 feet, maybe 50 feet deep there. And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. Now, I've been fishing before where we worked hard and we had an ice chest full of fish, and that ice chest sat neatly in the back of the boat, and that was a great day, but this is something entirely different. They're taking in so much of the fish that the nets are actually breaking, and when they are now hauling them up into the boats, the picture is it's not just the neat container or the holding place wherever they would have put their fish, but it's this picture of this whole boat is beginning to fill with fish, and now it's around their legs. Maybe now they're having to stand on top of the pile of fish because there's no place else to stand in the boat, because there's so many fish in the boat. Now the boats are reaching their maximum capacity, and so you get this picture of they start out, and here's the top of the boat, and here's the water line, and they keep taking up fish more and more and more, and that water line is getting close to the top, that edge of the boat, because there's so much fish that they are pulling in that there is this threat of the boats, and Luke actually tells us, so that they began to sink. Maybe now the boats are so low in the water that the water is starting to come up a lap over the edge, because the boats are so heavy. And these were not very small boats, because they were at least big enough to have a crew of men working on them, Peter and others with him. Now, what are we to do with this? What do we do at this point? Before we read next, There is some background from the Old Testament that we need to keep in mind. And I'm going to give you two examples. I'm going to give you a negative example and a positive example from the Old Testament that will, I think, help you to understand Peter's response. Now, here's the first negative example. If you'll look at Leviticus chapter 10. Negative example and a positive example that will help you to really appreciate what's going on in Peter's heart. Leviticus 10, then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Now, before you think that that was a rather extreme reaction on God's part for fire to come out and to consume these two sons of Aaron because they come into the holy place in a way that God had not commanded, keep this in mind, that Nadab and Abihu come with their little pans or their censers holding the fire. They come in the context of Exodus 19. You remember what God had said repeatedly about the mountain? He said, "You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death." God was teaching His people something about His holiness. "Not a hand shall touch Him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. With a man or a beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain." Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. The Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. Also, let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai. You warned us, saying, 'Set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it.'" The Lord said to him, "Away, get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them." Nadab and Abihu are coming to the tabernacle in Leviticus 10 in the context of Exodus 19 and God's statements about His separateness from them and His holiness that was not to be in any way violated except upon death. They have come in the tabernacle in Leviticus 10 in the context of all of the instructions for the tabernacle. In all of the laws that God has given already for its services and its furnishings, a tent of curtains that block everybody's view. All the tents, all the encampment of the nation of Israel around the other tent. There's our tents, and then there is the other tent with its outer wall of curtains that blocked everybody's view. You didn't just look in. God's place of habitation was separate from the general camp. It was distinct from all other tents in its construction and its appearance and beauty, so that only some could approach. Not all. Only Aaron and his sons could approach. The priests, you know who they were? They were the other tribe that were able to serve at the other tent. The separate tribe, the separate tent, who were these priests who were distinct in lots of things about them, and especially their responsibilities. They were distinguished by their clothing. They had distinct garments that they were to wear for glory and beauty, Exodus 28 tells us. There were clothes, and then there were the other clothes that the priest wore. You would look at a priest, and you would know he was a priest. You would know something of his distinctiveness. In the holy place sat the incense altar, and a coal from the altar of burnt sacrifice would be brought in. And it would be used to burn the distinct mixture of spices, and that recipe is given in Exodus 30. The incense that was used there at the altar of incense, you know what that was? It was the other incense, because there's incense. But then in Exodus 30, God gave the recipe for the incense that was most distinct among all incense. It was the other incense. And we read in that chapter, this is Exodus 30, this is a very interesting instruction regarding incense. God says, "But as for the incense which you shall make, you shall not make any for yourselves. According to its composition, it shall be to you holy," that is, it shall be to you set apart for the Lord, not for yourselves. "Whoever makes any like it to smell it shall be cut off from his people." So, just the mere possession of this incense was a felony. You're not going to have it. It is to be made for a specific purpose. You are not to be in possession of it just because you're curious what it smells like when it's burning. All of these things are the context of Nadab and Abihu. God's careful instructions. The timing of the incense offering. It was not just at any old time. It was the set apart times. In Exodus 30, God very carefully distinguishes the time that the incense offering was to be brought. And that's what Nadab and Abihu were doing. They're bringing the incense offering. But God had said in Exodus 30, "Aaron shall burn on it sweet incense every morning when he tends the lamps. He shall burn incense on it. And when Aaron lights the lamps at twilight, he shall burn incense on it." Well, why was the fire profane? We're looking here again at Leviticus 10. Well, the scripture tells us because it was profane. That is, it was strange. That is, it was unauthorized. It was unauthorized, and I think it was because they came at the wrong time. Because we read later on in Leviticus 16, listen to the words of how that chapter begins. "Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at just any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die.'" So I think that's what was going on. Unauthorized or strange, not what God had commanded, because they had come at some point, I think, apparently, other than morning or twilight. They decided to come and bring a hot coal from the altar and burn incense there in the holy place, right there in front of the veil that hid them from the Ark of the Covenant. Now, why was timing so important? Why make a big deal about this? Do you think when Aaron got the news about what had happened to his two sons, do you think Aaron might have thought that? Why is this a problem? Why? Okay, yes, God said morning and twilight, but they went in the middle of the day. Why does this have to be a problem? Did Aaron, was he tempted to think that? I don't know. But Moses says to Aaron in verse 3, when they had come and offered the unauthorized fire, probably at the wrong time, not what God had commanded, contrary to what he had commanded, and the fire comes out and consumes them, Moses said to Aaron, this is exactly what God was talking about. "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified.'" God is not a common God. And just like with Nadab and Abihu, he will not tolerate any representation of himself that would convey commonness or comparability. God will not tolerate it. God was to be approached according to his strict and unique laws that set his worship apart. They did not. This is their problem, Nadab and Abihu. Why such strict punishment? Why such a strict and severe response from God just because they came at the wrong time of day? Because they did not, in that action, they were not regarding God as holy. Through their lack of making the ceremony separate and distinct according to God's directions. Performing the ceremony according to God's distinctions shows God to be the Holy One. Okay, you follow this? Performing the ceremony in just any old way, it conveys that they are serving, and it would communicate that God, well, He's just any old God. He's just any old God. And we come to Him just any old way. He's common. So we just pick whatever time we come, and He's fine with that. It conveys that He's not holy. You understand now why the reaction was entirely appropriate. Had God tolerated that message portrayed would have been this. This would have been the message broadcast to the entire nation of Israel. Our God's common. He's just common. He's just ordinary. He'll be served in just any ordinary way at any ordinary time. The approach of Nadab and Abihu, considering the context of all the instructions that they had and all the things that they had seen, it was flippant, and it was dismissive, and it was casual. And they paid for it with their lives. Now, that's a negative example. Two men and their approach to God. Let me give you a positive example. Let's look at Isaiah 6. Pastor Larry referenced Isaiah 6 Sunday. So maybe good words that are familiar, ready on our minds here. Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. Well, who is He seeing? Well, He is seeing one who is in possession of all authority. That's what the throne represents. A king who has authority. He is high and lifted up. Another picture of authority. Notice that when Luke describes Jesus healing Simon Peter's mother-in-law, you notice he says that Jesus stood over her. He stood over her. This is a picture of the authority that Jesus was exercising over that illness. Okay, so Isaiah, he looks, he's given this vision. There's one. He sees the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. And the train of His robe filled the temple. You can kind of judge a king by his cover. And if he has a little robe, well, then he's a little king. Okay? If his robe is a little glorious, that tells you something about his power and his accomplishments. But if he has a more ornate robe, well, then you would say, well, he must be a greater king than the other king. And then you see another king, and his robe is so ornate and magnificent that it flows out from outside of the chair and it goes down the steps that leads up to his throne. And you would say, what a magnificent king he must be when you see the extent of his robe. But notice that here Isaiah is seeing one who wears a robe that fills the temple. So it billows out over the throne, and it flows out into all the little corners of the throne of the temple. It's all filled with the robe of this one who sits. You get the picture of who Isaiah is seeing, the greatness of this king, his power and his authority. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. And the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of Him who cried out. And this is just the voice of the attendant to this king. The whole place is shaken. And the house was filled with smoke. Another very clear Old Testament reference to deity. When God is there, there is the smoke, there is the cloud that hides us from Him. So the whole temple then fills with this cloud or this smoke. Now notice what Isaiah's response is in verse 5. Like a prophet that he was, like a prophet he would be, he makes a declaration of condemnation upon himself. Woe is me. He's pronouncing a curse upon himself. when he is granted this vision. Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of the people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Nadab and Abihu, they imagined that they were rich. They imagined that they were rich enough to draw from the treasure of their own goodness to invent a way to serve God. They came that day with a very high estimation of themselves. Oh, God will appreciate this. They trusted themselves to determine how He would be served and how His glory would be proclaimed. They trusted themselves to come up with a way to do that. Rich enough to think that God would be impressed and that God would accept an offering designed by them. Rich enough to think that they could actually improve upon what God had said and do a better job than even what God had conceived. So confident were they in themselves, so ignorant were they of who they really were approaching. And so ignorant of themselves as compared to the Holy One. And Isaiah says, woe is me. Woe is me. I am undone. Now, if you look again at Luke 5 and verse 8. Peter sees the fish that are hauled in, the boat's about to sink. Now think about it. There's not been apparently any preaching. It's just been a fishing trip. And all he's saying here at this point are the fish being brought on board and how many of them there are. In verse 8, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. Depart from me, for I am a sinful man. Peter looks at the nets. He looks at the boats. And something marvelous happens out there on the fishing boat. The Spirit of God with His sevenfold perfection of light shines upon the mind of Peter, and something dawns on Peter's thinking. Peter understands. By the working of the Spirit of God, it dawns upon Peter that there is one with him, and he's there in the boat with him, and he is holy. Now, we know that there's much that Peter will yet learn, but he knows this at this point. He knows that there is one with him in the boat who is holy. Peter begins to understand who Jesus really is. Putting together all that he had heard and seen, power, his wisdom, his goodness, his righteousness, he is the Holy One of God. Gabriel had already announced to Mary that her son would be great and would be called the Son of the Highest. And not only would he reign over the house of Jacob, he would reign forever. And not only that, but the power of the Highest would overshadow her, and thus she would carry the Holy One. Chapter 1, verse 35. And sadly, the only voices that we've heard in Capernaum up to this point identifying Jesus are the demons. They're the only ones so far. Remember, Chapter 4, verse 34. You remember what that demon said? I know who you are. I know who you are, the Holy One of God. And finally, Peter makes the acknowledgement. When he begs Jesus to leave, it's because he knows who he is. It's dawning on his thinking. When Peter cries out and says, depart from me, because I'm sinful, he's making the cry that Isaiah cried. This is a cry that Peter is making in the boat of woe upon himself. Jesus makes him uncomfortable. One sinner to another, we enjoy our company, right? But we would be very uncomfortable in the presence of one who is holy. And not only one who's holy, but one who has this power that Peter has seen in Capernaum. This one who speaks a word and the demons obey. This one who speaks a word and illness leaves. This one who, and Peter may not understand it all right now, but somehow, some way, this one who's in the boat with me is perceiving and understanding the mysteries of the deep water out here in the deep of the Sea of Galilee. He tells me to put my nets out. He knows. And if Jesus has this word of power over demons and illness, and he can, with a word, tell me to drop the net and it's filled with fish, what else does he know? Surely he can peer into my own heart if he can peer into the deep waters of the Sea of Galilee. You see, Peter is beginning to put it all together. Truth is being assembled in Peter's mind. And he cries out, "I am a sinful man. Leave me. Leave me." It isn't ignorance that makes Peter cry out. It's knowledge. Never before had Peter such a clear understanding of himself as when he understood who Jesus was. Calvin says this: "It is evident that man never attains to a true self-knowledge until he has previously contemplated the face of God." And you remember what Pastor Larry said Sunday is the face of God? His holiness. His holiness is his face. You want to behold God? What is it that these men are beholding? What is it that Isaiah beholds? His holiness. What is it that Nadab and Abihu so casually neglected? His holiness. What is it that makes Peter so terrified in this boat? And what is it that makes him make such a traumatic statement? It's holiness. There are rabbis. But Peter, now it's dawning on his thinking, the one in the boat with me, he's the other rabbi. There's lots of masters in this world, but it's now dawning on his thinking that he must be the other master for what he does and for what he says and for what he knows. Surely he knows me. Holiness. It's dawning upon Peter who is in the boat with him. Compare Peter with the crowds of Nazareth, if you will, in your thinking. Compare Peter with the crowds in Capernaum. Nazareth may have wanted something like this. The hometown boy does good. Maybe that's what they were looking for, which was a low fleshly desire. Make us, finally, somebody from Nazareth, he's going to make us proud. Something like that. Low, earthly, fleshly. They did not want a true prophet from God. They were not looking beyond the earth, and thus they did not recognize their true need. Capernaum, they certainly enjoyed the show. They liked feeling better, but they were not looking beyond the earth. And what a great hymn. What a great hymn we had, the second hymn we sang. I sang that thinking, this guy has been not only meditating on the Scriptures, he's been reading from Calvin's Institutes, the particular language he's using. They were not looking beyond the earth, and so they didn't recognize his true purpose. Calvin goes on to say this: So long as we do not look beyond the earth, we are quite pleased with our own righteousness, wisdom, and virtue. We address ourselves in the most flattering terms. But should we once begin to raise our thoughts to God and reflect what kind of being He is, and how absolute the perfection of the righteousness and wisdom and virtue to which, as a standard, we are bound to be conformed, what formerly delighted us by its false show of righteousness will become polluted with the greatest iniquity. And that's what happens to Peter on the boat that day. Whatever Peter had previously thought of himself, whatever was that false show of righteousness, I imagine Peter probably thought himself pretty righteous for letting down his freshly cleaned nets. I'll go ahead and do that. I'm a good guy. I've just cleaned them. I've just spent all morning cleaning them. In fact,
Master, I've spent all night. I've worked very hard all night cleaning and or fishing, and I've worked all morning cleaning my nets, but I'm a pretty good guy. I'll let down the nets. I'll go ahead and do it for you. Whatever that false show of righteousness Peter may have imagined within himself became polluted with the greatest iniquity because he began to consider what kind of being was in the boat with him. So Calvin concludes saying this, men are never duly touched and impressed with a conviction of their insignificance until they have contrasted themselves with the majesty of God. And Peter in this moment is feeling very, very insignificant. We will often find people here in the Gospels contrasting and comparing themselves with each other. Peter is contrasting himself with holy majesty, and he has found himself lacking. Depart from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. Woe is me, because I'm unclean. Never before had Isaiah such a clear understanding of himself as when he understood God is holy. Never before had Peter such a clear understanding of himself as when he understood that the one in the boat with him was the Holy One. So think about Peter's response. And here it is. Here's what we've been looking for. Here's the reception that's fitting for a king. Now, is this what you were expecting? Do you know who he is? You know he is the great king. But this is the reception that's fitting for him. That a sinful man would fall on his face before him. Did he fall? Did he just prostrate himself right there on the pile of fish? I don't know. Maybe Peter didn't care at this point. But here is a reception that's fitting for this kind of king, for a sinful man to cry out, confessing his wickedness to him. Let me leave you with this one final thought. And it's how this paragraph ends. And if you are one of those that have, you know something of what Peter is doing. You know something of what it means to come hungry. You know something of what it means to come poor and mourning to this king. You know something of what it means to receive this king as Peter is receiving him. Then what Jesus says next ought to be very encouraging to you. It ought to thrill your soul. It ought to strengthen your faith. Verse 9, for he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, are you reading it there? Do you see what he says? Think about the fact that God does not change. God does not change. Are we to imagine that Peter was less sinful than Nadab and Abihu? Was he somehow less depraved? Was he somehow more naturally righteous, more worthy of something good from God? Are we to imagine that? God has not changed from Leviticus 10 to Luke 5. Are we to imagine somehow that Peter had never, ever in his life, ever done anything to convey that God was common or that God was ordinary or that God was to be approached in a casual and flippant way? Are we to imagine that Peter had never done that? And yet Jesus, notice in verse 10, Jesus said to Simon, when Simon is confessing his wickedness to him, Jesus says to him, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Understanding Nadab and Abihu and Isaiah will help you understand the depth of Peter's outcry. But understanding Nadab and Abihu and Isaiah will also open your eyes to the depth of Jesus' mercy. What is it that Peter deserved at this point? Do we think that he deserved something better than what Nadab and Abihu had received? I don't think we can conclude that. And yet here he is, readily confessing that he is a breaker of God's law, a transgressor. Readily confessing that. And Jesus looks at him. Now, how do we measure that mercy? What tape measure would we use to get around the depth or the extent of this mercy and the forgiveness, which I think is what's happening here in the boat? When Jesus says, Jesus, the Holy One, looks at one who is unclean and wicked and sinful, a transgressor of God's law. When Jesus looks at Simon and says, do not be afraid. You know, for the first time in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is not rebuking or correcting the response that people are giving to him. For the first time, he's not rebuking or correcting the response that people have given to him. Maybe it wasn't what we were expecting for the reception of such a great king, but this is exactly the reception that's fitting because Jesus receives it. He doesn't say, there's no reason for you to be afraid. He says, don't be afraid. From now on, you will catch men. So when they had brought their boats to land, now this last line ought to make a little bit more sense to us. Maybe it ought not to be as much of a mystery to us, perhaps, as it was before. How is it that they just dropped all their things and followed him? Well, because they were there with Peter, hearing his confession and hearing the response that Jesus. So maybe it makes a little bit more sense to us when we understand what's happening in the boat, that they readily forsook all and followed this one. I can encourage you, if you will come to this one and call out to him for his mercy. What is it that keeps you from doing that? What is it that keeps you, even tonight? Maybe you'll leave tonight. You can lay in your bed. Nothing keeps you from doing this. You can lay in your bed and call out to this one for his mercy. Just drop all your arguments and drop all your excuses and all your self-justifications. You can just drop all of those. And you can call out to this one for his mercy. Confess your sins to him. Come to him hungry. Come to him poor. Come to him mourning over your sinfulness. You know, when you know what we're seeing here in the boat? We're seeing the gospel. A sinner says, I am so wicked. And the Savior says, do not be afraid. That's the gospel.